We literally are going to change the course of this country for generations to come. We're going to do it both at home and abroad, right here in Florida with all of you.
In 2016, Florida voted to fire the depraved political establishment, and you elected an outsider as your president who is finally, if you don't mind, putting America first. That's what we're doing.
President Trump and Joe Biden at dueling campaign rallies in Florida yesterday. We are in the final stretch of the election, and both candidates are spending their last few days in the swing states like Michigan, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, and, of course, Florida. Also, Texas, Arizona, and Georgia. Those Sunbelt states have become younger and more diverse, and now they are in play. Democrats hope this could be a pivotal year. But while polls show Trump is losing support among women and older voters, one bright spot in his campaign may be Latino men, despite his administration's harsh immigration policies. To be clear, most Latino men still support Biden, but recent polling in battleground states show Biden's edge only around 8 points among Latino men. And with just under 40% of them supporting President Trump, a slight uptick from the last election. And because they're concentrated in those Sunbelt states, they could be pivotal. Joining me now is Christian Paz, assistant editor for The Atlantic, covering politics and global issues. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Great to have you. All right. So is it turning out, as you're looking at these Sunbelt states, these swing states, that the Latino vote could be the key in these, whether or not Trump wins re-election or Biden wins election?
The president's strategy this time around has actually focused on Latino voters in the Sunbelt states. Something that's different from 2016 is that in 2016, when we did see a lot of focus on, you know, building the wall, on tougher immigration policies, there wasn't as much focus in the Trump campaign on actually trying to win support among Latinos. They were kind of just cruising along the expectation that Republicans would secure the normal percentage of Latino support that they get. Whereas this time around, we actually see that Latinos are a part of their comeback strategy.
And specifically, what about men? Because Latinas, women, they overwhelmingly support Joe Biden. But why is it a little more mixed for Latino men?
So this is an interesting question that we've been seeing pretty consistently come up, which is the issue of a gender gap in support for Joe Biden. We do see, like you explained, that Joe Biden only leads by about 8 percentage points among Latino men, whereas he has a much larger lead of about 34 percentage points among Latinas. Something that I think has been interesting to hear in my conversations with voters is you definitely see an appeal of the Trump persona that resonates with Latino men, whether that's his focus on, you know, his business credentials, which you see being something that's, or that I've seen has been actually quite appealing to Latino men who feel that they want to replicate a kind of entrepreneurial spirit that Trump has been playing up, or see his speaking about, you know, education, about small businesses, and about the pre-COVID economy, see that as being quite appealing in their own lives about what they want to see themselves accomplish. So in some ways, it's a little unique to the Latino community in the sense that there is a kind of, you know, appeal of business in the economy. But you do see that across other racial groups as well.
But it's interesting that the gender gap seems to be more pronounced among Latinos than other groups.
I think that's true. I think something that's also been interesting to hear is, you know, a focus in the Latina community on the role that they play in their own households. So something that I've been reporting on and wrote a story about specific to North Carolina, where you do have, you know, a big group of Latinas who are eligible to vote, who tend to be younger than the rest of the population, who see themselves now in a role of trying to support their families, trying to boost the message of political participation and activism in their circles. And that being because they are much more in tune, perhaps, with some of the bread and butter issues that affect their families, which might not necessarily be the same kind of priority that you see Latino men who are more focused on.
And What about when it comes time to vote? Because it's all very well to poll who you support and tell pollsters, oh, I support this candidate or that. But you obviously need to go out and make that a reality when you vote. What is happening with voter participation amongst Latino groups in the Sunbelt states?
I think you're seeing a big increase relative to historical trends. One thing that we've seen in this election cycle is a bigger appeal to Latinas specifically because they traditionally do not participate at the same rates that other women voters do. There's about like a 10 to 20 point gap in their participation in previous elections. And, you know, that's a lot of room and space to grow support. But one thing that is also interesting to note here is, you know, you have to distinguish between just the natural growth of the Latino population and the growth among younger Latinos who are becoming eligible to vote now, who are more progressive and hold more views that are probably more in line with the Democratic Party. Hold that on one hand, and also look at just the traditional support that you do see among Republicans in the Latino community. I feel like Democrats shouldn't be surprised if, even if there is a surge in turnout and there are more Latinos who go to the polls, that the percentage breakdown between Republicans and Democrats, once the ballots are counted, might be the same. It might stick around that 60 to 30, 70 to 30 breakdown. And given that we've seen Democrats kind of fumble a bit in their outreach to Latinos in general, starting late, not investing as many resources early on, while the Trump campaign has pretty consistently been targeting them with a message about individuality, about economic and educational opportunity, that we could see that percentage for Trump increase on election day.
Interesting. And that could be particularly apparent in Texas, which he won handily 4 years ago, but now could be up for grabs, even though the Biden campaign hasn't really spent much time or money there.
A lot of the folks that I spoke to for my latest work have been Texan voters who have said, right, that they haven't seen the traditional focus placed on them among Democrats who hope to flip the state. But the Trump campaign hasn't taken that for granted. And it also just goes back to this question of, you know, what kind of outreach Democratic and Republican candidates and their campaigns should be making. A lot of what we've heard is, you know, culturally competent messaging, advertising in both English and Spanish, going to the grassroots where there is a lot of activism in Texas, but making sure that you're not painting voters with a broad brush. This message that you see in a lot of Trump ads, which is, you know, you came to this country for a reason. You're seeking prosperity and opportunity, and we're the party that probably will get that for you. And there hasn't been a proper or sufficiently strong response from Democrats on this charge.
Christian Paz, assistant editor for The Atlantic, thanks for coming on the show today.
Thank you for having me.
Well, we've been talking about Latino voters in some of these key swing states, but white men still overwhelmingly support President Trump. Many are drawn to his portrayal of masculinity, an aggressive, macho, man's man, an alpha dog. We're going to talk about this now with Matthew Gutman. He's a professor of anthropology at Brown University. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Great to have you. Well, you study masculinity around the world, and one of your books is called, it's titled, The Meanings of Macho, Being a Man in Mexico City. And there is this line of analysis that posits Latino men are drawn to Trump because of his machismo. What do you think of that? Do you think that's accurate?
I think the fact, as you just said, that most white men are for Trump and most Latino men are actually not, says something more about the machismo of white men than Latinos. I think we associate the word machismo with Spanish-speaking people, but I think it can be used in a kind of racist way, like no matter how bad the guys are in the U.S., they're even worse if they speak Spanish. I just don't think it's accurate. I think you find plenty of machos in Mexico, but plenty all over the world.
So what is it about Trump's version of masculinity that is appealing to the white men who support him?
Well, I haven't looked at this specifically, so you're going to have political scientists who may know more. But what I would say is I think it is the open, sort of the untethered misogyny and the assertion of male privilege and impunity that captures not only men, but tens of millions of women are voting for Trump. And some of them may be holding their nose when they do it. But I think that a lot of them believe that's just the way guys are. Suck it up, deal with it, and move on. And most guys would do what Trump says he does or wants to do if they could get away with it. I think, you know, if you're looking at Biden, I think you see much more clearly an issue of sharing power. And that, not to say that there aren't women in the Trump administration, but it seems to me a much more explicitly misogynist kind of regime. And with Biden, clearly there's a lot more room for all sorts of people. Nonetheless, I think that Biden represents a different kind of very stereotyped masculinity in many ways, the defense of the family, the support of the family, the one who's always there to protect and whatnot. So instead of sort of operating on the realm of this person is a good person in general, we think in terms of, well, they're a good man or a good woman. And I think we're still operating sort of in the same very narrow boundaries of, if you're a man, what defines you is some kind of masculinity. Maybe, maybe not.
Right. Let me play a clip of Biden. This is him from one of the debates, the first debate, where President Trump was on the offensive trying to attack Biden's son, Hunter. And this is how Joe Biden responded.
Once you
None
became
of that
vice president, he made a fortune in Ukraine, in China, in Moscow,
that is simply
and various
not
other places.
True.
He
my
made a
son,
fortune.
Gentlemen, my son.
And he didn't have a job.
My son, like a lot of people we know at home, had a drug problem. He's overtaken it. He's fixed it. He's worked on it. And I'm proud of him.
Okay, so is that what you're talking about, that he's portraying a more nurturing side of masculinity, the family protector, if you will?
Sure, but I would also argue that we're still operating, you know, if a man acts nurturing and caring, I often hear that he's acting like a woman or he's acting like a mother. And that may be a positive thing. He's acting in a very motherly way. And I just don't understand why nurturing is automatically associated with women. Just as if a woman is acting aggressive, I don't think she's acting like a man. I think she's acting aggressive. But I think we still operate in a very gender binary kind of world where everybody has to fit one of the other categories. So there's clearly a lot more room for women in power in Biden's vision. But it's part of it is just, you know, a woman's touch or a woman's perspective or a woman's this or that. It depends on the woman, just as it depends on the man in terms of, is this characteristic in some way? So 9 out of 10 murderers are men, and that's incredibly important. Very few women are very few murderers are women. But the number of men who murder is infinitesimal. So to think that men by nature are murderers or aggressive, we exaggerate, I think, the extent to which that is somehow true. And what we end up with is arguing ultimately that men biologically operate a certain way. They have to do this, they have to do that. And I think that's one of the things that Trump's gotten away with. This is just the way men are. And I think that's incredibly
boys will be
dangerous.
Boys.
I think we let men off the hook.
Locker room talk, all that. Also, this idea that is very hard to bury in the American mythology of the rugged individual, the John Wayne archetype, the Marlboro man, that kind of thing. And that it is that is the pinnacle of masculinity. Why haven't we been able to shake that idea?
Well, I wouldn't say we haven't been able to. I mean, let's remember 66 million or something people voted for a woman last time, more than voted for a man. So it's not like everybody's walking around with that same idea. But clearly, there are massive problems of inequality between men and women. You know, the Senate is only a fraction women still to this day. So these ideas and these kinds of relationships of inequality exist all over the place in a serious fashion. But feminism and gay rights and whatnot have done a lot to shake up the kinds of power arrangements and move us in a different direction. And I think it's important to recognize the changes. 100 years ago, if you and I had been talking and we'd said, well, why aren't there any women leaders in the world, political leaders, except for a few queens, we might have said, you know something, women just don't make good leaders. And if they did, don't you think we would have seen some? Clearly, there are some people who might argue that now, but a lot fewer people, fortunately. And we've seen tremendous changes, particularly in terms of women in their lives. I think we're lacking in terms of men really turning some things around on a widespread level. But men have also been supporting this these kinds of changes all along as well. Some men, not all.
Yeah, I want to play a clip of Trump from earlier this week at a rally in Michigan, a key swing state, where he's trying to appeal to suburban women. And here's what he said.
And you know what else? I'm also getting your husbands. They want to get back to work, right? They want to get back to work. We're getting your husbands back to work, and everybody wants it.
Huh. So what do you make of that? That seems, again, a throwback to this idea that it's the husband that goes out and works and the woman who stays at home.
It's outrageous. More women are working now in the workforce than men in many realms. And the notion that it's the men that want to go back to work and the women only are concerned about that is outrageous because it's just factually stupid. But it is revealing in the sense that I think not all, but some of his base among women believes that, you know, if I have to work, that's a problem. Maybe I will do work, but really it should be the man who's working and not the woman. And I think these kinds of retrograde ideas are widespread. And it's not just ignorance. It's not just, you know, they don't know better. It's that that's what they believe in their heart. That's after thoughtful consideration about what women should be doing in the world and what men should be doing. They believe in that kind of a world. And so I think it's really, it's a very different kind of society that tens of millions of people in the United States want to have. I don't think it's too different when you're talking about white privilege and impunity as you're talking about male privilege. I think that Trump stands for white privilege as well as male privilege. And I think there's a lot of white people who think that's just dandy.
Matthew Gutman from Brown University, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
Coming up, why the FDA approved remdesivir to treat COVID despite studies saying it's not effective. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. The FDA approved remdesivir as the first treatment for COVID-19 last week. It's been approved for emergency use since spring, and it was part of President Trump's cocktail of drugs he used earlier this month. Early in the pandemic, people had high hopes for remdesivir, but results from a big World Health Organization trial released just days before the FDA approval are disappointing. The WHO found remdesivir had no effect on deaths or on recovery time. Other recent studies on the drug show that at best, remdesivir helped hospitalized patients recover only slightly faster. So why the FDA approval? Well, some in the science community say it's politics. Joining us to talk about this is John Cohen, senior correspondent for Science. Welcome.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, remdesivir is a treatment for COVID. It's not a vaccine. And so what do its proponents say it does?
Well, it's designed to cripple the virus. And in clinical trials staged by the U.S. National Institutes of Health, it reduced the time to recovery for hospitalized patients, particularly if they were on low-flow oxygen. So this is a subset of a subset, from 15 to 10 days.
Okay. But what were the results from this big WHO trial study on this drug?
It didn't work. It didn't reduce mortality. It didn't reduce time to recovery. The big difference between the two studies is that the NIH study had a placebo control, and the WHO study had what's called a standard of care. So it just compared people to people who weren't treated. In the world of science, a placebo control is the gold standard, but standard of care also is a valid way to compare a new treatment to figure out whether it's working.
And again, the NIH study said that it reduced hospital stay by 5 days in this subset of patients.
Yeah. So, you know, in all likelihood, it has some activity and does something positive. The question that is debated is how widely should it be used? Should it receive FDA approval? You know, there are lots of things that have a little bit of activity, but they don't do enough to warrant a drug approval. And maybe it will work really well in combination with something else. We saw this with HIV. There were lots of HIV drugs that were pretty mediocre on their own, but in combination, they were a bang-up part of a combination cocktail. So that's the debate, and the real question is, why weren't these issues publicly aired through the system that the FDA has to publicly air debates like this?
Are normally in these kinds of situations, there is a robust public debate on the approval of a drug?
Well, that's a tricky question. I mean, the FDA has advisory committees that are set up that are independent, academics, doctors and pharmacists and a consumer representative, and they can call those groups together to discuss controversial topics. Is this a controversial topic? Yes. They have not convened this committee once during the entire pandemic that looks at antiviral drugs. Why haven't they convened the committee? Good question. And people on the committee asked me, what do you think's going on? They don't know what's going on. And in stark contrast, the FDA gathered on October 22nd, its advisory committee for vaccines, to simply consider the question, what if we have efficacy data for a vaccine? Should we issue what's called an emergency use authorization? Now, remember, these EUAs were issued very controversially for hydroxychloroquine and for convalescent plasma, and one was also issued for remdesivir in the spring.
And for hydroxychloroquine, it had to be revoked.
It was rescinded, and it was seen as a political move on the part of President Donald Trump. And the convalescent plasma announcement occurred on the eve of the Republican convention and was again, and Donald Trump, President Trump, called it a historic breakthrough, which basically no medical experts believed. So those were seen as very political EUAs. The remdesivir EUA last spring wasn't criticized. You know, we are in a desperate situation. We want to try things that have a possibility of working without granting them full approval. We do want people to have options because of the stakes here. People are dying who, if you can save them with an experimental medicine, think about your family. What would you want? Of course you would want to gamble. But at the end of the day, before we market something and allow, you know, basically every doctor to prescribe it anywhere, we need good, solid evidence that it's safe and effective. And that's what's in dispute here.
Is there any evidence that it is not safe?
There are signals that of side effects that are serious. And it appears in several studies, including the WHO study and the NIH study, if you give it to people on ventilators, they do worse. So if you use it broadly, you might see some benefit in some patients and harm in other patients, and it's a wash at the end of the day if you lump it all together, and that's the essence of this dilemma.
And meanwhile, it's not cheap. It's more than $3,000 for a five-day course of treatment, and apparently Gilead has made a lot of money on this, $873 million, apparently, since the spring.
Yeah, in their third quarter, they announced that this week. And it has to be infused. So it's an IV drip drug. It's not something you throw a pill in your mouth. And that means you have to be in a clinical setting to get it. And that costs money, too. So, yes, it's not cheap. And the European Union just inked a deal with Gilead to purchase it for $2,400 for a course of treatment. And they signed that purchase agreement, that pricing deal, on the eve of the WHO data becoming public, but they didn't know those data, and Gilead did.
So why do you think that all of these governments are in such a rush to approve this drug?
It goes back to the desperation. You know, desperate times call for desperate measures. We've been doing a lot of things that are desperate. And, you know, we don't have anything else. This is the first FDA-approved antiviral for COVID-19. It's the first treatment approved.
John Cohen, senior correspondent for Science Magazine. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Coming up, we will have your Friday film reviews.
So it's not a good movie. It's not worthless. It's a tween-based horror film for the Halloween weekend. Then it will go away.
Dave White and Alonzo Duraldi are here next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Time now for Friday film reviews. Halloween, of course, is this weekend, and two of my favorite critics were sure to include some scary movies in this week's selection. Alonzo Duraldi and Dave White, film critics for The Wrap and hosts of the podcast Linoleum Knife. Hello, you guys.
Hello.
Hello.
Are you dressing up at all?
Yes, I'm wearing my annual costume, which is the old dude sitting on the couch in his underwear eating candy.
Okay, I'm here for the verisimilitude. I love it. Okay.
And I pretty much live my life as sexy George Lucas, so I'm just going to go with that.
That's very true. Very true. Okay. So, life is imitating art. Let's start with a wholesome, sweet documentary, yes, the pun intended, about a Cambodian refugee who created a donut empire in Southern California. It's called The Donut King, and here's a bit from the trailer.
Ted opened up 70 donut shops, and he gave Cambodian refugees a chance to really make it in America.
President Bush Sr. flew from the White House to give me a presidential award for achieving American dream. Imagine a man with nothing, penniless, come to the most powerful country in the world, and he built something. I lost everything.
Okay, sounds very dramatic. And this is the story of all the mom-and-pop donut shops here in Southern California. Basically, the idea of this one guy, Dave?
His name is Ted Noy. He was a Cambodian refugee who arrived in Southern California in the mid-1970s, and he needed work to support his family, so he got a job at a Winchell's donut shop, where he learned everything about how to run the place, from the top to the bottom, and he saved every spare penny, and then he wound up with his own shop, which in time became a chain known as Christie's Donuts, named after his wife, and they became an empire of independently run shops that beat back the tide of Winchell's and Dunkin' Donuts for supremacy in California. Now, we love our donuts in California, especially mm-hmm. Los Angeles, where there is one donut shop for every 7,000 people, compared to a national average of one donut shop for every 30,000 people.
Wow.
And we really love our local donut shops because they're better. They just are better.
And didn't he pioneer the pink box?
He did. He's the reason why we have pink boxes for donuts. And there's a fun Amazing. Little montage from movies and TV of people, you know, characters on TV holding pink donut boxes. And they're like, this is because of Ted Noy. What makes his story so special, and there's a little bit of a spoiler in that clip you played. I was surprised. But Uncle Ted, as he is known, he built this network of Cambodian-owned donut shops across the West Coast, and he created this solid base of cultural input by Cambodian people in the United States. So, you know, for that reason alone, and the not small pleasure of making donuts so much a part of everyone's life, you know, he's one of the reasons you can give to any anti-immigrant jerk you might know for why the United States thrives with immigration rather than the other way around.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I'll say there was once an interview with Michael Tolkien where he said that the only person who could really write the L.A. story, because it's such a varied landscape, is the late Jonathan Gold, because it's really the food that ties us all together. And so this documentary is very much about the Southern California love of donuts, but it's also about how this one immigrant was able to build this business and welcome in all of these fellow refugees from Cambodia to run the business to make this happen. And so it is this great sort of Horatio Alger story. It's why we should welcome refugee stories. And it's a Southern California is shaped by the things that we put into our mouths story.
But I just want to note that there is a spectacular fall from grace as well to this story.
Exactly.
So it's not all cheery on the up and up. He squanders his fortune.
He did, and that's the little clip that you played. This is a story about becoming too rich and hubris and what can follow after. It's not, I'll give you another spoiler, it's not a bummer of an ending.
No,
but it's you go through it with him.
And it also sort of addresses the notion of you have these refugees who come to this country, they work really hard, they make these shops into a success, and then they send their children to school, and then their children have other ambitions in life than to take over the family donut shop. And so now we're sort of at this pivot point where, like, will they continue? Will these families continue to keep the businesses alive? In some cases, yes. In other cases, no. And so it is sort of a snapshot of this moment.
Okay, moving on to another film, a foreign film, and this is an older one called Damnation. It's been remastered, and this movie came out in 1988 when Hungary was still a communist nation. Why is it out now? Simply because it was remastered, Dave?
Well, it's out now. I believe it's out now primarily because of the wave of attention and success that greeted the restoration of Bela Tarr's 7.5-hour epic Satan Tango, which now
streaming on the Criterion Channel.
Now streaming on the Criterion Channel. Now this film, Damnation, is Bela Tarr's sort of transitional film. Now, over the course of our 25-year-long relationship, Alonso has frequently referred to me as a miserabilist. But on my best doom-filled day, I cannot hold a candle to Bela Tarr, because if I did, he would blow out that candle, and then he would extinguish the sun, much like he did in his film, The Touring Horse.
What is this movie about?
It's the story of a man played by Miklos Székely, in a remote Hungarian mining town, who is obsessed with his married lover, played by Vali Karikis. So he arranges for her husband, played by Georgi Saralmi, to be the courier for an unspecified package. And he will get a cut in of about 20% of that payout. That puts the husband out of town so that the man and the woman can continue their love-hate affair, where they can't keep away from each other, but they really are not into each other on any other level other than the obsessive physical.
They're madly in love, but they don't like each other.
Right. It's no spoiler here to say that it ends unhappily, because then it would not be a film by Bela Tarr.
This is the perfect movie to watch if we want to just wallow in our noir-ness. Let's talk
noir-itude.
Our next film is in Spanish, so we're not going to play a clip from the trailer. It's called Madre, and it's directed by Rodrigo Sorogoyen. And Alonso, what is this movie about?
Wow. Okay. Well, speaking of movies that will that will not put you in the greatest mood, but are still great, Marta Nieto plays a woman named Elena. And as the film opens, she is in her apartment in Madrid, hanging out with her mother, and she gets a phone call from her 6-year-old son, who is on a trip with his father, her ex-husband. And the child is alone, and he doesn't know where he is, and he's scared and confused, and she's trying to sort of like talk him down and find out where he is so she can send help or call the police or whatever. And the phone on the battery is dying, and eventually she loses contact with him just as some stranger is approaching. So the first 15 minutes or so of this movie is every parent's worst nightmare. We then cut to 10 years later, Elena is now living on that beach in France where she thinks her son disappeared, and she's managing like a seaside bar. And one day she sees this teenage boy who's there for the summer and kind of becomes fixated on him as the thought of like, is this my kid? This is what my kid would look like. And they develop this relationship that you're never quite sure where it's going. And even they don't seem to be quite sure where it's going, but it's certainly upsetting to her boyfriend and his family. And over the course of the film, you know, she's sort of forced to kind of come to some conclusions and some self-confrontations that she's been putting off.
Did you like it?
I liked it very much. It is Marta Nieto's performance is just riveting. I mean, that opening phone call scene is already this great sort of like acting showcase. But then over the rest of the film, she creates this character of a woman who, you know, has this bundle of grief on her back that never quite goes away, although she will occasionally, like, you know, she has moments where she is enjoying herself, or she's, you know, she gets drunk, or she, you know, like, she exists in the world and she is coping in the world. It's not like she's completely always weighed down, but it's also never not there, that sense of loss. And so when she fixates on this boy, Jean, played by Jules Poirier, who you know, you can tell from the camera the way that she looks at like his mouth or his eyes or just things about him that like just click with her, is like, this is what my kid would look like. Is this my kid? It's really engrossing, and you don't really ever quite know where this is going to go. And it does sort of, everything that happens builds in a logical way, even though it goes to some kind of crazy places, but it goes to those crazy places because she's dealing with so much loss and grief in her life.
Hmm. Dave, did you like it?
Oh, yes. Now, Damnation may be gloomy and bone cold, but this one will fill you with that sort of unresolved anxiety and panic and then sorrow.
But at least it's at the beach.
As the characters play out these damaged relationships, heavy, heavy Vertigo vibes with this one. And you may find yourself yelling at the screen from time to time.
So our final film is called Come Play. And, well, that title alone tells me all I want to know about this. It's focused on a kid named Oliver. He's got autism and he encounters a terrifying monster named Larry. And here's a bit from the trailer.
Hello? This thing wants our son.
A friend. He just wants a friend.
Stay away from my son. Did you turn it on?
Finish the story.
All right, Alonzo. This is, it sounds like typical Halloween fare.
Yeah, it's a PG-13 horror movie, and so you can, any trailer that has that many thunks in it, you know, is going to have a yeah. lot of jump scares. So, Ajay Robertson, who was the kid in Marriage Story, and he was one of the sons on The Plot Against America, plays Oliver. He has autism and communicates through a program on his phone, a sort of a touchscreen thing, and, you know, obviously spends a lot of time looking at screens. He watches a lot of SpongeBob SquarePants, and one day on his phone, this scary story called Misunderstood Monsters appears, and it's about Larry and how Larry wants to be your friend and Larry wants to cross over into your world and bring you back with him. And of course, given all the situation that Oliver's dealing with, it's difficult for him to communicate this to his parents, who are played by Gillian Jacobs and John Gallagher Jr. Eventually, enough people see and experience Larry that they realize that, no, this is a thing that's happening, and they have to figure out how to stop it. But it's fairly routine. It's not particularly scary. And they introduce a lot of ideas around the character's autism and the parents, you know, coping mechanisms with that, but they don't take them to anywhere particularly interesting.
All right. Is it scary though, Dave? Did you at least get some Halloween kicks out of it?
I do not respond to jump scares, but there's another person in this house who does. And so when we were watching it on the couch, it got him a few times. So it does deliver occasionally on that level. And the performances, as Alonzo said, are good, you know, across the board, even when the material is seemingly intentionally confusing. So it's not a good movie. It's not worthless. It's a tween-based horror film for the Halloween weekend. Then it will go away.
if you want to watch a new movie for Halloween, I would say you're better off staying home with The Craft Legacy.
All right. Alonzo Duraldi, Dave White, film critics for The Wrap and hosts of the podcast Linoleum Knife. Thank you both.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Happy Halloween. It's also Dia de los Muertos this weekend. What it means this year, next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Dia de los Muertos, or Day of the Dead, takes place every year on November 2nd. Here in Los Angeles, there are typically celebrations that last for days around the city, complete with brightly colored costumes, painted sugar skulls, of course, marigolds, in honor of loved ones who've died. This year, with the pandemic disproportionately affecting Latinos, Dia de los Muertos has added significance. It's also not going to be as public, obviously. Here to talk about this year's celebration is Gabriela Martinez. She's Director of Education at the Museum of Latin American Art. Welcome.
Hi, Madeline. Thanks for having me.
Great to have you. Well, typically, this is a big deal for your museum. You host a month-long celebration with tons of activities, workshops, a festival. What are you doing this year?
So this year we scaled down a bit. We have been indefinitely closed to the public since March, and we're not sure when we're going to reopen. So everything is taking place online, and we've cut it down to 2 weeks of programming, though we are archiving everything. So it'll be available for a few months afterwards.
And what are you going to do online?
We actually started on October 18th, and it's a series of different events. So we are starting with our artists talking about the way that ofrendas have been put into contemporary art. We are having two different music events. We did more traditional indigenous music with Martina Espino last week. We actually have a more contemporary DJ set with DJ Catra, who's based out of the East Coast. And then we're organizing a series of workshops. So calavera puppets, paper flowers, papel picado lanterns, nicho making workshops, painting. And then finally, a couple of food programs. So we had a chocolatl and pan de muerto demonstration. And then this weekend, we'll have a mole workshop with a couple of local scholars.
Hmm. That sounds delicious. And it sounds really fun. And this holiday, it is typically a fun holiday. It's really, celebratory. I mean, it's called Day of the Dead, but it doesn't feel like a morbid funeral. And is that how you see it?
So, yeah, typically what it's been is that it really is more of an acknowledgement and a celebration of the complete cycle of life, right? So that includes birth, your life on earth, and then your life in the afterlife as well. And so the roots of it are from indigenous Mesoamerican festivals of the dead and rituals, which were blended, right, with Catholic religious rituals as well. And so it's really a time where it is seen as the veil between the land of the dead and earth is opened up. And so we're allowed to reunite with our loved ones who have passed away.
Is it different this year? Does it feel different this year because of COVID?
Definitely. You know, it really is based on this idea of building a community, whether it is with your family or with the community that you've built around you, your friends and neighbors. And this year, because we are isolated, we're not able to really come together and have the big celebrations that we usually organize. So it has taken sort of a different turn this year.
Right. And so maybe being online and having what you're doing online is even more important because it's a way to connect. Maybe some families have not had the ability to do that. And even to say goodbye if someone died of COVID in the hospital.
Yeah.
What are you hearing from museum goers and people who normally celebrate Day of the Dead in full force? What are they telling you about this year and how it's different for them?
Well, we've actually had a really positive feedback with all of our online events. I mean, last year we, welcomed 5,000 people, to the museum for our festival. But we usually have about, 1,200 to 4,000 people anytime when we have a festival. And they've really enjoyed kind of getting together online and connecting with people in the communities, because maybe they have been interacting with each other, but, it's all been socially distanced and with a mask. And so bringing people into the homes of, these local chefs and artists and things like that has really created that connection that I think people are craving right now.
Can you talk about your interpretation of the ofrenda, this idea that you are inviting community members to send in photos for it and the artist is interpreting them?
Every year we build a community altar at the museum, usually in the lobby or outdoors. This year we're not inviting people to come on site, but we are building an ofrenda or an altar with artist Nauj Lonam. And so what they are doing is that they are taking virtual entries, so photographs, dedications, messages from people, and they're printing them on these beautiful, colorful paper flags. And they've actually already built out a landscape in our lobby that is based on a pencil drawing that they made. And they will be covering it with these different sized flags that have the images of the loved ones on there. And what we're doing is we're unveiling it on Sunday, November 1st. So there will be a talk with the artist, and then we will be documenting it and photographing different aspects of it, and then creating an actual video documentation that will live online. And so we'll be focusing on different images and messages and things like that, and sort of creating that community remotely.
Mm. What do you recommend people to do if they want to celebrate at home, in not in a public way? Is there something that they can do, create their own ofrenda and their own celebration?
Of course. So the wonderful thing about this idea of reuniting with our loved ones is that it is a very universal feeling, I think, that we can all partake of, right? We've all lost somebody at some point in our lives. And so what Dia de los Muertos calls for is for us to remember them and to honor them and to, create these ofrendas, which are offerings. And so what is central to that is obviously an image of the loved one, usually in a frame, in a place of honor. You can build this on a table. You don't necessarily need to have the tiered structure to do this. You can add nice family heirlooms in the forms of textiles and vessels. And then what you want to do is you want to fill these vessels with some of the loved one's favorite things. So you can talk about, sweets, if they had a sweet tooth, some of their vices that they left behind when they left Earth, and some traditional foods that are actually featured usually on the altar are things like pan de muerto, which I already mentioned, which has like an essence of orange and anise and has a decoration of crossbones over it. There's also mole, which I'm sure most people in Southern California are familiar with, the chocolate savory sauce, right, with meats. And then also pozole is something else. And then you want to add colorful decorations. So you can add papel picado. You can add marigolds, which are actually called cempasúchil, or flowers of the dead, which are the traditional flower that also lures the spirits back from the afterlife. And then, of course, candles as a way to light their path. But also, if you are religious, right, another way to offer prayers as well. Mm. Other symbols that are really popular are monarch butterflies. And these are thought to also bring the spirits of the dead back during this time, but they've also become a really interesting symbol for migration as well, right? Moving back and forth, which also ties into this idea of moving back and forth between the other world and the earth as well.
Gabriela, thank you.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Gabriela Martinez, Director of Education at the Museum of Latin American Art. It's in Long Beach. And you can find out more about their Dia de los Muertos virtual celebrations at their website, mola.org. Well, that's it for Press Play for this week. Our producers are Rosalie Atkinson, Brian Hardzinski, Angie Perrin, Rebecca Mooney, and Nihar Patel. Michelle Aloy is our line editor. Sarah Sweeney is our managing producer. Amy Ta is our digital producer. Mario Saavedra and Phil Richards are our technical directors. Have a happy, spooky, safe Halloween weekend and Dia de los Muertos weekend. I'm Madeline Brand, and I will see you on Monday.